Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Charles Garvin, your moderator for this program, and it will be my pleasure to introduce a dear mentor and teacher to not a few of us, I think, this evening, Professor Lawrence Tribe, the University Professor of Constitutional Law at Harvard Law School, to kick off a conversation among all of us about his informative and provocative new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. As a brief backgrounder, Professor Tribe was born in Shanghai, the son of Russian Jewish parents. His family found its way to San Francisco, where he attended Lincoln High School, right here, before entering Harvard in 1958 at age 16. So, Professor Tribe, first things first, welcome home. You should know that your San Francisco Giants have a 7.5-game lead in the National League West. Professor Tribe graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School, clerked for California Supreme Court Justice Matthew Tabriner, and then for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. He's taught at Harvard Law School since 1968. And in those 46 years, Professor Tribe has authored 115 books and articles, including the definitive treatise American Constitutional Law, which is the most cited legal text in the United States. Professor Tribe, though, is much more than a legal scholar. He has personally argued more than 35 cases before the Supreme Court and dozens more before federal courts of appeals throughout the United States. His truly startling record of achievements in the field of constitutional law led former Solicitor General Irwin Griswold to write of Professor Tribe, "No book and no lawyer has ever had a greater influence on the development of American constitutional law." Professor Tribe brings all of that perspective and knowledge to bear in his latest offering, Uncertain Justice. This new work, co-authored with his former student, Joshua Matz, is a stunning reminder that the Supreme Court is a complex organism comprised of 9 justices appointed for life whose actions, as we'll hear, defy easy analysis or prediction, but whose words and opinions affect virtually every decision we make, whether it be the partner we choose, the wars we fight, the criminal penalties we impose, the words we utter, the money we contribute to support candidates, the health care we receive, and that list goes on and on. So the importance of tonight's topic hardly needs restating. Professor Tribe, we're honored to welcome you tonight and hear you weave Uncertain Justice's complex tale of a Supreme Court that, as you observe, mixes competing beliefs about what the law requires with a fundamental disagreement about the role of courts and litigation in American life. Please, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Professor Lawrence Tribe. You bet.
Thank you so much, Charlie, and thank you all for being here. I do feel like I'm coming home. I recognize a lot of people here in the audience, and I loved growing up in San Francisco. I miss it, and I'm glad to be back. I co-authored this book with the best research assistant I've had in a number of years, and I've been really lucky in the research assistants and in the students whom I've worked with during my 45 years of teaching at Harvard. Now, I hear myself say 45 years, and I think, my God. You know, when I first started teaching at Harvard, if somebody had said I've been teaching for 45 years, I'd say, and you're still alive? But I'm still very much alive. The people that I've taught and worked with include Justice Elena Kagan, Chief Justice John Roberts, fellow you may have heard of, Barack Obama, as well as former Congressman Barney Frank and Congressman Adam Schiff from California, and lots of other judges all over the country. Now, I'm not saying that my co-author, Joshua Matz, will definitely be elected or appointed to high office someday, but stranger things have happened. Next year, for example, he will be a law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy. And you all know, I think, what a pivotal role Justice Kennedy plays in lots of issues of considerable importance in our lives. This summer, another one of my research assistants went home to New Hampshire and spent some time talking with his high school music teacher. He's a terrific research assistant named Max Rosen. His teacher, who was apparently pretty terrific herself, knew that Max had just finished his second year of law school at Harvard, but didn't know that he had helped me with anything relating to a book about the Supreme Court. But she had a good question. She said, what's up with all these 5-4 decisions? You know, you have to be blind or deaf not to know something about how the court is rendering lots of them. And a lot of people, including people that I read and trust and like, Linda Greenhouse and Adam Liptak, Justice Breyer, Steve Breyer, who also grew up the same time I did here in San Francisco, make a big deal of how unusual it is for the court to be so closely polarized and closely and frequently divided. In a recent speech, Steve Breyer said that it's sort of become a junior varsity Congress. And that's pretty disillusioning for people who want the Supreme Court to be less blatantly political. So Max's teacher wanted to know, how could she avoid being disillusioned by the political polarization with the historically unprecedented number of 5-4 decisions, and especially 5-4 decisions divided along what she thought were partisan lines? Max, fresh from actually reading Uncertain Justice for the first time, you know, it's like describing different parts of the elephant. One person works on the trunk, one person works on the belly, somebody else on one of the tusks, or whatever you call those. I guess they're ivory tusks. And you don't see it whole. But he had read it all, and he was filled with answers that he thought would help her. He said, it's true that the Roberts Court has decided more cases, 5-4, than the Rehnquist Court, but only by a tiny amount. 21.5% of the decisions of the Roberts Court from 2005 to the present have been 5-4s, as opposed to 20.5% for the Rehnquist Court. Not that big a deal, but there was less said about it then. The rate of the Rehnquist Court is double the share of the 5-4 rulings by the Harlan Fiske Stone Court during World War II. And the Stone Court had 3 times the rate of 5-4 decisions of any prior court. So there's a steady curve. You might think what that means is that the justices are increasingly political or increasingly confused or something. But historians of the court have shown that those trends represent pretty much nothing. That is, they represent the outer face of the court, not the degree of internal division, which it turns out was deep and persistent all the way back to the dates of the great Chief Justice John Marshall. Chief Justice William Howard Taft, from 1921 to 30, who had been president earlier, managed with his dominating personality to stifle outward dissent. But there was plenty of division inside. His successor, Charles Evans Hughes, 1913 to 21, kept the lid on as well. But Hughes' successor, Harlan Fiske Stone, encouraged the justices to let it all hang out. He believed that stifling dissent and separate writings and concurrence was unhealthy. He wrote, justices should be free to assert their individuality, impose unanimity, and you get nothing good in the development of the law. It reminds me of the wonderful statement by Justice Robert H. Jackson, compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. He said that famously in the case where kids were suspended or expelled from school for refusing unanimously to pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. There were times since Stone that the court struggled to mask its internal divisions. The initial vote in Brown v. Board, it turns out, was 5-4 the other way. That is, the court was going to reaffirm Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. But Warren had been a powerful political figure, knew how to herd the cats around him, and he produced a unanimous judgment. Roberts expressed hope in 2005 when he was being vetted for the Supreme Court by the Senate Judiciary Committee that he would preside over another Taft-like era of at least outward calm and consensus. But as you all know, that wasn't to be. It wasn't consistent with the tenor of the times, people letting it all hang out, speaking their minds, whether on the right or on the left, or with the political inexperience of all nine justices. It's a very different court in that respect from what we had, for example, during Earl Warren's chief justiceship, when all of the justices had been either, as Douglas was, head of the SEC, or as Warren was, attorney general and governor of California, or as others were, people elected to office. Hugo Black had come from the seat in the Senate. Now they all come from the farm team. That is, they essentially are all appointed from the Court of Appeals, usually of the District of Columbia, the only exception on the current court in terms of Court of Appeals experience being Elena Kagan, who was, in a way, a kind of politician. She had to be a politician to herd the cats at the Harvard Law School when she was the dean. And then she served as Solicitor General and then became a justice of the court. So it's a mistake to think that we once upon a time had a golden age of a unified court in which the justices agreed on the meaning of the Constitution. They have never agreed. And it doesn't bother me that they've never agreed, because how could they? I mean, the terms of the Constitution, its aspirations, its structure, are so profoundly open-ended and subject to competing interpretation. And not only that, but the world itself is subject to competing understandings. So that if we want a Supreme Court of actual human beings rather than robots programmed by some master builder to interpret the document in one way and apply it to the world in one way, we've got to have division. The question of whether it's good or bad to have that division is an interesting question, but it shouldn't confuse us. It shouldn't make us think, well, now they're all just politicians because it's 5-4. And the outward division, apart from not necessarily signaling more politicized motivations, suggests the opposite. If anything, it is unanimity on hard questions that should trigger suspicion. I mean, not everybody knew when Earl Warren came down with a unanimous decision in Brown v. Board how he had to work hard to get them all together and how political the decision was to present a unified face to the country on so divisive an issue. But that is the truth. Fears, in addition, that 5-4 rulings are especially likely to trigger backlash rather than generate broad acceptance are historically unsound. There's no correlation between the split within the court and the survival of the court's reputation as somehow above the fray and as not simply a political body. Look at the lopsided majorities in cases that proved the most remarkably divisive. Dred Scott, 1857, the only Supreme Court decision that essentially triggered a civil war, was 7-2. Brown v. Board, 9-0, was hugely unsettling. How many of you remember, only the older ones in the audience, I guess, all those impeach Earl Warren billboards around California and around the whole country? Roe v. Wade, 1973, not exactly a harbinger of calm and consensus, was 7-2. It helped trigger the Reagan Revolution, and it determined in many ways the increasingly right-leaning tendencies of some justices appointed by right-leaning presidents. Duh, elections have consequences. It shouldn't be surprising. The reason we use a political process to select justices is that we know that they make subjective judgments necessarily about the meaning of the law and the nature of the world. Bush v. Gore, 2000, was 5-4. Did it lead to enduring reduction in respect for the court? Some people might intuitively think so, but the polling doesn't show that. In fact, the polling about approval of Democrats for the court's overall performance and of Republicans tends to show in recent polls that by now more Democrats than Republicans approve of the Supreme Court's performance overall, despite the reputation of the Roberts Court as right-leaning on most hot-button issues. Lawrence v. Texas, 2003, when the court rendered its landmark ruling on gay rights, even though it was in a case that dealt with oral and anal sex, regardless of whether it was a same-sex couple or an opposite-sex couple. And United States versus Windsor decided last year, striking down the Defense of Marriage Act. Lawrence was 6-3. Windsor was 5-4. Neither has been deeply polarizing. Both have been broadly accepted. There is a virtual cascade of lower court judges, all not only applying Windsor enthusiastically, but extending it to hold that same-sex marriage must be recognized by every state under the federal constitution. Citizens United in 2010 and McCutcheon this year, 5-4. It's not the split, it's not the close division of those cases, but the bottom line that has proven hard for a lot of people on both sides to swallow, partly, as I show in the book, and as Stephen Colbert showed quite brilliantly, and I begin the chapter on Citizens United with some vignettes from Stephen Colbert, because it's so easy to caricature, it's so easy to make it look like, oh, the court doesn't seem to know that corporations are not really people. They don't cry, they don't love, they don't raise children. Duh. I mean, that's all true. But the court was protecting speech, not speakers, saying that regardless of the source, we don't trust the government to decide how much various entities should contribute to the public discourse. It was not about corporate personhood. Now, Max's teacher took all of that in and replied by saying, okay, so maybe all of that history shows that sometimes hidden division within the court goes all the way back, but it doesn't show that the Roberts Court is uniquely polarized. I get it. And it doesn't show that we're in danger of losing respect for it, but maybe we should lose respect for it. Why can't they get it all together? Why can't they agree? But again, the reason, and I think Max has largely absorbed that view, the reason is that the issues are so difficult that it would be problematic if they all agreed. It does show that the picture John Roberts tried to paint in his confirmation testimony in 2005, remember he said, I think justices should be nothing more than umpires, calling balls and strikes, not pitching or batting. But that picture was as phony as a $3 bill. Just as Elena Kagan said in her confirmation testimony 5 years later in 2010, said that's really a misleading image. Max's teacher was right. That is a misleading image. She didn't swallow it. She's a baseball fan. She understood what one umpire meant when he famously called the strike zone a living, breathing document, like the living Constitution. Now, I'm sorry I don't have a story in the book about the San Francisco Giants or the Oakland A's, but there is a story about something else, and I want to mention it to you. No Boston Red Sox or St. Louis Cardinals fan will ever forget the umpire's call of obstruction against the Red Sox third baseman, Will Middlebrooks, for finding that his legs were in the path of a Cardinals player named Alan Craig, who was racing from third to home plate. The third baseman wasn't trying to, in the language of the baseball rule, impede the runner's progress. But nonetheless, he was obstructing, and that was the umpire's call. It gave the Cardinals runner the game-winning fifth run when Game 3 of last year's World Series had been tied 4-4 at the bottom of the ninth inning. That win put the Cards ahead of the Sox 2-1 in the series. Although, of course, being the better team, the Red Sox won it all in Game 6. And I was rather glad about that because I happened to be able to wangle a ticket to Game 6, so I got to see the winning game. Justice, therefore, prevailed in the end, uncertain though it might have been. The outcome was the same, but the course of the series was totally altered by that difficult judgment call, and that's true with a lot of the difficult calls the court makes. Sometimes the bottom line is not all that different, but the path between here and there is remarkably altered. John Maynard Keynes once said, in the long run, we're all dead, but the path from here to there can be dramatically reshaped by the way nine people, nine human beings, very bright, but not automatons, not robots, call things. And apart from all the judgment calls required of umpires, and especially of justices, judgment calls that have to reflect the way the people making them interpret the invariably ambiguous rules, like rules about obstruction, do they require intent or not? And they have to reflect the way the people making those calls perceive and experience the world. Apart from that, the Roberts metaphor is doubly misleading because justices, unlike umpires, have to make the rules. Every justice, including those who say our job is to channel the original meaning of the Constitution, every justice says publicly and in many ways and in many occasions, we make the law. That's what we do. The Constitution is a broad framework, but the rules for implementing it, how do you make sure that there are no unreasonable searches and seizures, or that those who engage in them pay a price? Do you exclude the evidence and let a dangerous criminal go free? Do you let the evidence in and make it easier for people to sue the cops and sue municipalities? The Constitution says nothing about how to implement the Constitution's values. And when society changes and technology changes, how do you apply the Constitution's language, the language about unreasonable search and seizure? Is putting a GPS device under some guy's Jeep and following him for a month an unreasonable search and seizure? The justices have to decide that, and they have different ways of deciding it. In that case, again, giving the lie to the idea that close division on the court is what makes the difference, in that case, the court was unanimous on the outcome. You could predict they would have been. When the argument began, Chief Justice Roberts asked the hapless guy representing the U.S. government, "Do you mean to say that under your position, you could put a GPS under my car and follow me around for a month without any reasonable suspicion or a warrant?" And of course, the guy was lost right then and there because he couldn't have said, "No, no, Mr. Chief Justice, the nine of you are immune." that wouldn't have worked. The only sense in which the umpire analogy holds up is that we do expect judges, like good umpires, not to bend or twist the rules they make to ensure that their favorite team brings home the pennant. And the only modern Supreme Court case, in my view, in which there is any real basis, and it's not all that strong, to suspect that that may have been going on at the court, at least unconsciously, was a case decided 5 years before Roberts got there, though it's a case without which he might well not be there, and that is, of course, Bush versus Gore. For all the rest, what happens at the court, and in the ways that its rulings shape nearly every facet of our lives, is necessarily a function of how nine unique individuals with nine very distinctive sets of views that can't be reduced to simple cardboard cutouts about activists and those who are restrained, about liberals and conservatives, how they bring their experiences and assumptions and philosophies to bear on some really tough problems involving often conflicting constitutional values, in which there really are often no ultimately right answers. It is the dialogue, the search for answers over time, the conversation between our framers and those who will come after us that is at the heart of the constitutional enterprise. And that's why I think that as citizens, we all need to understand better what the process is all about and not simply fall for the cardboard cutouts. So Max, quite loyally, advised his music teacher, "Read Larry Tribe's book." "Go, Max." When she asked whether she would understand and enjoy it, she, after all, was not a lawyer, she doesn't know legal lingo, he pointed triumphantly to the dust jacket and quoted from a couple of the blurbs, like Doris Kearns Goodwin, and I know it's painful for me to read this, but a brilliantly layered account of the Roberts Court, filled with memorable stories and striking references to literature, baseball, and popular culture, this book is a joy to read from start to finish, an irresistible narrative that will delight the general public as well as journalists and scholars. Thank you, Doris. That obviously warmed my heart. Or from Jeff Toobin. relentlessly fair-minded. I'm not so sure what relentlessly fair-minded means, but in its judgments about the justices and their work, an indispensable guide to the court's recent history and, more importantly, to its future. Or Ted Olson, my adversary in Bush v. Gore. Fascinating, penetrating, highly readable, and even-handed. I could go on, but I'm afraid my head would burst, so I won't. Here are just a sample story or two. There's a cool one about Justice Potter Stewart's devotion to the Cincinnati Reds, which extended to making sure that his law clerks were watching a tiny TV set that he put in his chambers while he sat on the bench during the 1973 playoff between the Mets and the Reds. The clerk knew his boss's priorities well. In mid-argument, he sent Stewart a note, "Crane pool flies to right. Agnew resigns." A lot of the stories in the book are chosen to explode the myth that the justices can be neatly divided into conservative and liberal camps. For instance, there was the story of Arizona's Show Me Your Papers anti-immigrant law that the court struck down 5-3. Now, if your arithmetic is good enough, you will realize that's not quite adding up. Well, Kagan was recused because, as Solicitor General, she had been involved. Kennedy wrote a poetic opinion for the majority, celebrating our national identity as a land of immigrants yearning to breathe free. He was joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Chief Justice Roberts. Scalia went apoplectic. He wrote a dissent that called the court's decision mind-boggling, and he went out of his way and outside the record of the case to attack Obama for an unrelated use of executive power to favor the innocent immigrant children known as Dreamers. It had nothing to do with the case, but, you know, he had the podium, so he was going to mention the president's excessive use of power. The Washington Post, which usually selects the president or a senator or a cabinet member for the honor bestowed on Justice Scalia, its worst week in Washington prize that week, partly because of the over-the-top reaching beyond the record, but partly because he was also outvoted in the Obamacare decision that came down 3 days later. But don't assume that Scalia always plays the heavy. If privacy rights are involved, he is pretty much the most progressive justice. Not always in his reasoning, but he somehow manages to find a way to get there. More characteristic of Scalia's hard-nosed jurisprudence was his vote this Monday against a boy who had been brought from El Salvador by his mom at age 13, but who had had the bad luck to turn 21. It's called aging out. He turned 21 while his mom was still waiting in the slow-moving line to get an immigrant visa. Scalia read the applicable law to mean that the boy had to go to the back of the line instead of keeping his place in line alongside his mom. He joined an opinion to that effect written by the Chief Justice. But guess who else was on that side of the case? Writing the principal opinion against the boy from El Salvador was Elena Kagan, joined by Ruth Ginsburg and Anthony Kennedy. The four dissenters who would have let the boy keep his place in line, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Stephen Breyer, and Sonia Sotomayor. Now, unwrap that one. You know, if you ask what's the liberal-conservative split, that's not it. You have to understand these people as human beings, and that's what this book tries to help you do. Among the most intriguing and illuminating divisions within the ranks of the five justices appointed by Republican presidents are those between Scalia and Alito. When Alito was named, lots of people, oh my God, I only have 5 minutes left. I have so much more to say, but read the book, that'll do it. They battle one another furiously about free speech, privacy, and the need to stick to the original meaning of the Constitution. For example, in the case about selling violent interactive videotapes, Alito told one of the lawyers arguing before the court, "I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is what James Madison thought about video games. Did he enjoy them?" And in the opinions arising out of that GPS attached to the guy's Jeep, Alito mocked Scalia's attempt to analogize GPS tracking to a constable hiding in a coach for weeks to monitor the owner's movements. See, that was a kind of 1791 analogy. In his concurring opinion, Alito wrote, "Something like that might have occurred in 1791, but it would have required either a gigantic coach, a very tiny constable, or both, not to mention a constable with incredible fortitude and patience." Well, since I have very little time left, I guess this was advertised as a reading from the book, let me close by reading two short paragraphs from the chapter called Freedom of Speech, Sex, Lies, and Video Games. Throughout the late 1960s, the justices of the Supreme Court spent at least a day every year in the basement watching porn together. I was there, it's true. By all accounts, it was fantastically awkward. Unable to define obscenity, but convinced that the First Amendment couldn't possibly protect it, the court was forced to create constitutional law one sex scene at a time. The films ranged from scientific documentaries to the improbable escapades of lesbian nymphomaniacs. Justice Thurgood Marshall, the civil rights hero, took merciless pleasure in narrating the clips for the special benefit of Justice John Marshall Harlan II, an elegant former Wall Street lawyer who was by then losing his eyesight. Radhika, did Marshall do that even when you were clerking? Well, I think Marshall got embarrassed and then handed it over to the clerk. Mocking Justice Potter Stewart's insistence that I know it when I see it, clerks would call out in the dark, "I see it, I see it." In 1968, some 20 years after serving in the Navy, a still youthful Potter Stewart reflected on more adventurous times and confided in a particularly curious clerk, to figure out who that might have been, that he had indeed seen it just once off the coast of Algiers. Thank you very, very much.
All right, wonderful talk, Larry. Our thanks to Lawrence Tribe, noted professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. And it's now time for our audience question period, and this is something we do frequently at the Commonwealth Club, and I must say that I have never seen such a voluminous set of questions, and I would say they range about equally scholarly and abstruse and really impassioned, so I think it's interesting. They also range from some specific topics of con law to the process that you bring up in the book, Larry. Mm-hmm. I'll start with an impassioned one. You say it's good to have division in the court and that there is evidence of nuance in decision-making. But come on, even I, who know little about the psychology, can predict with about 90% accuracy in advance how the current justices will line up. I therefore believe that polarized deliberation is a sham. There is no real deliberation if even I can already know how the justices will vote.
Well, whoever asked the question, I need to hire as a consultant because my batting average is not 90%. I'm pretty good, I think, compared to most. I predicted that Roberts would vote the way he did in the Affordable Care Act case, that he would rely on the taxing power. But the best I can do is about 80%. So whoever it is must have one hell of a crystal ball. And besides, it's not only the result that counts. Even when we know with some degree of certitude where the court is going to come out, like I think we can be pretty sure that they are going to say that the Massachusetts buffer zone around abortion clinics suppresses more speech than it needs to protect women. We don't know exactly what the division will be or how the reasoning will impact the future of abortion rights. And we also don't know how the decision's reasoning will impact the future of speech rights and rights to protest and rights to express a point of view to the very people that you think most need to hear it. And those are what count for the long run, not only the ultimate outcome in the case. And I could really say essentially the same thing about most of the remaining really difficult cases that the court seems to stack up and wait for the end of the term to decide. So I do repeat, though I admire the passion, I think it's important to understand what's going on.
Do you think that you do stress nuance and give compelling and flavorful stories throughout a very engaging book about the justices and how they think and how that's influenced their decisions? Do you think it's more or less nuanced in the Roberts Court than in other courts? You alluded to Bush v. Gore. You know, would that be a crudely political decision if the fact situation were exactly the same but the parties at issue reversed? Would the decision be the same?
Well, that's something I've asked myself for the last 14 years, because having written the briefs in Bush v. Gore and argued the first of the two cases, you can assume I wasn't a happy camper when the court rendered its decision. I've written long, long articles, one of which is called The Unbearable Wrongness of Bush v. Gore. I did, in the remarks that I made, give that as the one example where I think the justices sort of may have let their inner desires to see one guy win rather than the other prevail. But even there, I make an argument about 50 pages long, much less accessible than anything in the book, which doesn't talk about Bush v. Gore, about why that's not a very plausible way to explain what the court was doing. And I won't go into it, but I think that that's sort of an exceptional case. I don't think the level of nuance in this court is really very different from, in terms of internal beliefs, from that of the Marshall Court, and I mean John Marshall, not Thurgood Marshall, or the Hughes Court, or the Stone Court, or the Vinson Court, or the Warren Court. These are usually very accomplished, interesting people with interesting lives, probably a little less interesting on the whole now than in some prior years because of the uniformity of the justices. They all went, after all, to either Harvard or Yale. Now, I've got nothing against Harvard, and not even against Yale. But there's surely some room for UC Berkeley and USF and the University of Nebraska. But subtlety is an evasive quality. It's hard to measure. It's hard to quantify. I'd say that we are lucky in the intelligence and the nuance of these justices. Though, of course, like I suspect many of you, I wish that Gore had won rather than Bush. I know some people like Ralph Nader, whom I haven't talked to since then, although he used to be a friend, said it didn't matter if he ran, and he, more than the Supreme Court, tilted the election that way. Iraq, the various justices appointed by George W. Bush. Of course, as I said earlier, elections have consequences, even when they're not necessarily elections by the people.
To stick with process, a number of folks are asking an issue that I might not have expected that has to do with the impact that every individual can have because of lifetime tenure. Mm-hmm. In your view, you know, can and should lifetime tenure on the court be fairly eliminated? If so, what tenure might you recommend?
I'd recommend an 18-year non-renewable term staggered so that every president gets, in the long run, two appointments. So we don't have a situation where some presidents get a large number of appointments and others get none, and where some presidents project their ideology and their personality decades into the future. It's important that the term be non-renewable, because you don't want justices having to stand for reappointment and therefore trying to please their masters. One of the good things about life tenure is that none of these people owe a thing to the president's, incumbent or otherwise, who appointed them. But I do think that a system that was designed when people didn't live nearly as long doesn't work quite so well now. Now, constitutional amendments are extraordinarily hard to pass. Over 2,000 have been proposed. Only 27 have ever run the full gauntlet. So I don't hold much hope in such an amendment, although it's not impossible. Some have proposed a solution that would not require a constitutional amendment. If you read the Constitution with some care, it doesn't necessarily say that a judge appointed to a life tenure shall be an active justice of the Supreme Court for life. That is, they could be rotated out so that they sit in various circuit courts and no longer on the Supreme Court. The court might want to strike that down. I mean, you could sort of think, well, you know, I gave up some cushy stuff to get here, and now I've only got, 14 years, 5 minutes left. But the court might also be rather embarrassed to be ruling in its own case in that way. So that's something that I think Congress, when it finally gets around to doing anything, and is no longer wholly paralyzed, should take seriously.
Somewhat relatedly, in terms of the personalities, do you think that appeals court experience, especially as narrow as it has been, as you point out, or experience arguing cases before a U.S. appeals court, should those be the key requirements for selecting justices? Might we be better served by appointing qualified politicians to the court, like Earl Warren or deans of the Harvard Law School?
Yes.
Okay. Perhaps relatedly, this is a little bit more lighthearted. First Amendment, freedom of speech. We can now evidently bully and threaten anyone until they do us actual harm. Should this also apply to the justices?
Well, people did try to bully Justice Souter. He rendered a decision about the ability of states, if they choose to do so, to use eminent domain, to take private property for more lucrative development. He said that was a public use of property, and it was not a violation of the Constitution as long as they got a fair price. He didn't vote that he liked that system, but he did think that there was nothing in the Constitution that prevented states from doing it. And so many people in his home state of New Hampshire were really ticked off about that, that they started to get a petition going to take his house, his little house by eminent domain, a place that he loved so much that he left the court to go back to it. It didn't go anywhere, but that was the kind of bullying that I suppose they might have in mind.
Right, right. Well, let's follow that in a personal question that one person asked who may know you, and that is perhaps more than any other person, you probably know so many jurists and scholars who influenced jurists and the justices themselves over the decades. I can certainly say that, having taken constitutional law from you in the same room that also held John Roberts. Does that make it difficult to write candidly about them?
Not really, because I'm 72. I don't have any aspirations for public office. I can say what I really believe, including saying that Justice Scalia makes this or that outrageous claim or something else. But I do find that when you know them, it's a little more difficult to hate them. I mean, that much is true. That is, I have a sort of generous attitude toward all of them, including ones who are not very popular with most of my friends, because I've gotten to know them, and I see that there's a there. There's a real soul. Now, some of them have deeper souls, in my view, have greater compassion, greater empathy. I find them easier to get along with, but I do find them hard to demonize. And I think that helped. It helped me write the book. It helped me write it in a way that strikes people as even-handed and fair-minded.
We're used to thinking that a principal objective for all branches of government is legitimacy, and you speak to it, several times. In your view, if you overview the Roberts Court and its holdings, do you think they've net contributed to or detracted from the legitimacy of the court?
Well, it's hard to say, but I do think that when some members of the court, like Steve Breyer, go around making speeches saying that the court is too political these days, I think they're forgetting a lot of their history and they're making a statement that might become a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, if enough people that you generally like or trust or believe say enough bad stuff about an institution, you're going to start believing it. Now, I do think that it's important that we not fool ourselves about the court, that we not pretend that they're just umpires, that their life experiences and their life views don't matter. I mean, that's pulling the wool over our own eyes. It's very much like, and some people would find that comforting. It's like Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, who believed that miracle, mystery, and authority in the Brothers Karamazov were what the people needed. They need to have a kind of Wizard of Oz in whom they can believe and in whose infallibility they can have trust. I don't think in a democracy we need that. I even have sometimes thought that they're wearing black robes and dressing up in this fancy, almost priest-like manner contributes to a mystique that we don't really need. You know, everybody, of course, stands up out of respect when the justices enter the chamber, just as they stand up when the president enters the room, even though they may not like that president. But I think beyond showing a decent amount of respect, it's hard to believe that they should be treated in a priestly way. That's why I personally did not object when your former classmate, well, it wasn't Barack Obama. You were in John's class.
That's right.
Oh, sorry. You know, when you've got all these great students like Charlie and John and Radhika and Barack, and I mean, I could keep naming people in the audience who sometimes blur the chronological chronological telescope. When Barack Obama confronted the court sitting in the front row during the State of the Union message and called them out for Citizens United, which he thought was terribly misguided, and he had some harsh words for the court. And Alito, when the president said, this means that foreign influences can enter our politics, Alito muttered under his breath, but visibly to the cameras, not true. Well, A, I don't think there was anything wrong with Barack Obama confronting the court. The thought that he was trying to intimidate them is ludicrous. B, I don't think there's anything wrong, although it was pretty obviously unseemly, and he hasn't shown up at a State of the Union message since, with Alito saying not true. And see, Alito was right. That is, the Supreme Court has since, though without explanation, held that Citizens United does not prevent Congress from silencing foreign corporations and preventing them from spending money in our elections. There's no principled basis for that distinction. The whole theory of Citizens United was that the Constitution protects speech, not speakers. And so in the Bowman case, when the court, without explanation, just affirmed a lower court decision, it was really abdicating its responsibility. And while I'm on that particular sort of jag, I want to say that I think one of the worst things the court does, and it's not just the Roberts Court, the court quite often abdicates by basically keeping the country in the dark on really hard questions that need to be settled. I mean, for example, once the court decided that the right to bear arms in the Second Amendment applies to individuals who are not part of any militia, one obvious question that remained, many remain, but one obvious one was, is it a right to bear arms only at home? Or if you're maybe 85 or 90 and you're taking a walk at night in order to stay alive, that you may have a right to have a gun then too. The Seventh Circuit said, yes, you have a right to have a gun then. The right to bear arms is not just a homebody right. Other courts have said, oh no, the right to bear arms applies only at home. The country is divided about that issue. One of the court's main functions is to give a uniform national answer to serious, difficult, and divided questions of national law. And the court has been mum. It keeps denying cert. And when the court denies review, of course, it has no obligation to explain why. That, I think, is an abdication. And I think it's an abdication for the court not to have said what it really meant to say in the case about foreign corporations. But I got on to that, if you will remember the tortuous path, by commenting on Alito's muttering not true when Obama, in fact, made a mistake in the State of the Union message. But I don't think there was something wrong with him confronting the court, because I don't think the justices are emperors, I don't think they're high priests, and I don't think they deserve to be treated as such.
Maybe we ought to put big white wigs on them. That might.
Well, some people think after the decision gutting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that it should be a white hood.
Right. Absolutely.
Now, that's not what I necessarily think.
You just touched on the right to bear arms, and since so many of our questions did light on individual issues that you treat in the book, maybe we should alight on one or two of those. Do the arms matter? Two of our questioners essentially asked the same question. When the Second Amendment was written, people used muskets as arms. Today, almost anyone can buy a machine gun. Can an argument be made that this was not exactly what the founders envisioned?
Sure. They didn't envision the kinds of weapons that we have today. They didn't envision cell phones or the GPS either. You know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander if we're really going to apply the Constitution, not in terms of the principles it had in mind and what it was generally understood to do in terms of principles, but in terms of the examples that would have occurred to the people who wrote it, then we really are stuck with the analogy of the carriage and the tiny constable, or with whether James Madison really would have liked video games. It seems to me that it's true that people aren't using muskets these days, and that does bear on the kinds of regulations that should be upheld. And the court has made clear, though it's odd that in an opinion that talks so much about original meaning, they talk about current popular culture. They've made clear that the thing that's primarily protected is a handgun, a pistol, of a sort that certainly didn't exist in 1791. It doesn't protect a bazooka. It doesn't protect nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction, although, of course, an AK-47, in my view, is a weapon of mass destruction. But I don't think it's decisive at all that the framers wouldn't have thought of that example. Those who wrote and ratified the 14th Amendment thought, for example, that segregated education in public schools was just fine. If we were bound by that original expectation of those who wrote and ratified the Equal Protection Clause, Brown v. Board would never have come out the way it did. It would have come out 5-4 the other way, as it almost did, in fact. But even people who believe in originalism, original meaning, like Scalia, make clear that they are not talking about preserving the examples that occurred or would have occurred to the framers. They're talking at a different level. What were the principles that something was originally understood to embody? Take, for example, the clause of the Constitution saying that the United States shall protect the states against domestic violence, insurrection and domestic violence, okay? Now, today, when you hear domestic violence, what do you think? You think of spouse beating, you think of child abuse. Does that mean that this gives the government national authority to deal with problems of spouse beating and child abuse? I don't think so. Not because that wasn't the example that would have occurred to the framers, but because they were talking about a different animal altogether. They were talking about riots in the street, and they were talking about civil unrest. And that does make a difference. In a sense, we're all originalists in one way or another. That is, we're dealing with a document, and we're not free to just treat its words as putty. We're not free to simply treat them as an empty vessel into which we pour whatever results we would like.
Mm-hmm. Relatedly, several questions discuss the current policy of the government and the Supreme Court's opinion about it in the following terms. Today's government asserts absolute power to spy secretly on individuals and place them on secret watch lists. Has the Supreme Court ceded too much power to the executive in matters of national security?
Well, I do think that the Supreme Court has deferred too much to both Congress and the executive branch when the magic words national security are used. One example that occurs to me is a decision from a year or two ago where some human rights groups wanted to turn terrorist organizations into organizations that use less violent means and that instead use peaceful means of resolving matters. Very naive, but being naive is not necessarily a sin or a crime. They wanted to teach terrorist organizations how to petition the United Nations. Congress passed a rather general law that the executive branch interpreted as making that a crime. It's a crime to try to teach Al-Qaeda or some other organization to be more peaceful. The court upheld that in a closely divided vote by deferring enormously to the executive branch. So the executive tells us that any help at all to a terrorist organization is going to help them kill Americans, regardless of your intent in helping them, regardless of how targeted the help is. Roberts wrote the majority opinion. Breyer dissented. He's not the strongest guy on the First Amendment, but he dissented saying, this gives too much power to the executive. And I agreed with that. Now, in the particular case of the NSA's spy regime, the court was not eager to review its constitutionality, its consistency with the ban on unreasonable searches and seizures, at a time when the people challenging it had a hard time proving that they were victims of the practice. That is, the government hadn't admitted that it was doing this, and it certainly hadn't admitted that it was doing it to all of us, that it was collecting all of our metadata. The NSA has data on every person any one of you have called on a cell phone. It doesn't have necessarily, or at least they tell us for now, that it doesn't have the contents of your conversation, but they don't need that. They can do a full profile of all the websites you've visited, of all the people that you've gone to, you know, that you've reached out to by email. They've got a whole profile, but they hadn't admitted it. And so various groups like the ACLU and various journalists wanted to challenge the practice, and the Obama administration said, hey, who, me? You know, whether we're doing that or not is top secret. We can't admit it. And because you can't show that you were the victim, the court can't touch it. And the court went along. It said, okay, we're not going to review it. Now, that was consistent with the court's standard practice of not reviewing something unless you can show you're hurt by it. But now that Edward Snowden has revealed everything and the government has pretty much admitted that it has got all this data on all of us, that will not work. The government will not be able to say we don't have to defend this under the Fourth Amendment. And there are strands of opinion going back to the 1960s that will allow the court, if it decides to interpret the Fourth Amendment that way, to say the government has gone too far. That for it to collect all of this data, even if it's true that it's kept in a little lockbox and that they can't reach into all of it without a further warrant, is an invasion of our privacy. And that's what I hope they'll hold. Scalia and Ginsburg, who are good buddies, even though they are quite often on opposite sides of things, they go to the opera together, they hang out together, they give speeches together, and they were both asked, do you think the court will address this issue? And they both said, yes, we're not going to be able to avoid it. Scalia said, it's a damn shame because we don't know the first thing about this high-tech stuff. Ginsburg said, maybe that's what will give us a fresh-eyed view of the underlying principles. I tend to view it more the way Ginsburg does than Scalia, but it's clear that the government can't forever be given limitless power if we want to live in a free and open society, not a society in which we are transparent to the government, but it is completely opaque to us. But the idea that the government has been given absolute power, that's the part that I think overstates it. That is, the Supreme Court, even under Roberts, has issued opinions, though he hasn't always gone along with them, saying that a state of war, and that's what we're in, even though there's no declaration of war, there was the authorization for the use of military force, the AUMF after 9/11. A state of war is not a blank check for the president to do whatever he wants. There are limits. The court is not very vigorous about enforcing them, and it has sometimes let the president get away with, I was going to say murder, but that's a little too literal. But there are limits, and the court reserves the power to impose them.
Yes. And as a reminder for our listeners, this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're speaking with noted Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe about the workings of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Charles Garvin, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. And Professor Tribe, we have several other questions that also go to policy, and these again are, you know, quite impassioned. I'll summarize with one of them. What's up with the Roberts Supreme Court ruling in favor of pro-business campaign finance, effectively allowing corporations to fund all their favored candidates? Isn't the division inherently anti-democratic and oppressive to minority interests?
Well, I'm not a great fan of Citizens United either, but I see it as more complicated and having more sides. It was unions as well as corporations that the court said the government couldn't silence or tune down. It was not just corporations. And among corporations, it was the mom-and-pop grocery store that happens to incorporate, as well as GE and GM and Lockheed. And in addition to that, the court was focused on not so much that they have the right to dominate our discourse. The court actually admitted, though not as forthrightly as I would have liked, that it is potentially dangerous to democracy that some people, because of their wealth, can have more access and more influence, even though they're not necessarily buying elections. We saw that in the Eric Cantor loss to Dave Brat, when Cantor spent 20 times as much on his campaign as Brat did, and he still lost. So money isn't everything, although it's an important thing. But the court's concern is with restricting government, not so much with empowering business. It basically says that giving the government the power to kind of orchestrate how much speech from which corner is too much, how much spending on speech is too much, that that's dangerous. And that once we go down that road, we have sacrificed a lot of what the First Amendment is about. That's one of the hardest decisions the court has decided. It's appropriate that it was 5-4.
You know, here a couple of times, and in the book certainly, you've taken issue with the umpire metaphor that Roberts used to describe his prospective role at his confirmation hearing. If a justice needs to be more than an umpire, maybe umpire is also not a bad word, what should his role or her role be, and what role does the judge's personal history play in the decision-making process?
That's such a big question. I try to teach year-long courses in that. I mean, the role should be to honestly say as truthfully as you can what the Constitution you think means and what it represents in terms of the values of the United States of America, and to apply that to your sense of what's going on in the world as best you can, not to second guess the empirical judgments of the other branches when it's truly an empirical question, and not to follow the election returns, not to live up to a stereotype of yourself as a right-winger or a left-winger, but to call it as you see it. Now, that doesn't tell you very much in terms of the bottom line in any particular case, but I don't think there is a formula, an algorithm, that can answer that question. I mean, if there were, somebody could write it into a computer program and we wouldn't need justices, let alone 9 of them.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we really only have time for one last question, and my prerogative as moderator is to make it, you know, my own. After reading the whole book, Larry, and reflecting on the stories that you do tell of how judges reach their decisions and the different influences on them, and how much the law is shaped by 9 individuals with widely different points of view, and that influences the evolution of the law and certainly its evolution during the Roberts court. You know, it struck me there's a parallel to a Harvard colleague, I guess, Stephen Jay Gould, describing natural evolution and drawing everybody's attention to the way in which it's not a certain thing that, you know, amphibians could go lead to reptiles and then to mammals and finally to us up here on this podium, but it's the result of accident, historical accident. Mm-hmm. And right. Just reading your book, it strikes me that you can say the very same thing about a lot of these decisions. And yet, in a stirring passage at the very end of your book, you say that the arc of history is nevertheless toward justice. What makes you so sure?
I wish I could be sure, but that's an act of faith. That is, I do agree deeply that a lot of it is accident. It's accident that brings us all here. You know, if your mom and dad or whatever had been doing something else that night, who knows? If some, you know, there was a pilot whom I eventually represented who was strafing houses in Shanghai. He was an American pilot, and the house right next to where we lived in Shanghai was bombed. And this guy was Hugh Lidke, the CEO of Pennzoil. And as we were going to the Supreme Court, where I was arguing Pennzoil versus Texaco, we realized that our paths almost crossed in a very strange and accidental way, but it didn't quite. I think there's a lot of accident. When people look back, they tend to think that everything that happened was inevitable. We all have this deep feeling that it's inevitable that we exist, right? And there's this wonderful book by James Holt, Why Does Anything Exist? It's not inevitable. If certain constants in the universe were a little bit different, there could be no life on the planet Earth. So it's all accident. It's accident that Lochner versus New York, that a lot of people excoriate, was decided 5-4 as it was. Our whole history contains accident. And yet at the end, you have to either believe the glass is half full or half empty, and I choose to believe that it's half full.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, our warm thanks to Lawrence Tribe, professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Uncertain Justice, The Roberts Court and the Constitution. We'd also like to thank our audiences, both here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We'd like to remind everyone here that copies of Professor Tribe's book are on sale, and he'll be pleased to sign them outside this room. Just following this program. We also appreciate this is a very crowded room, you're letting him make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Charlie Garvin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Good. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. Great fun.